Welcome to the Entertainment Engine.
Hi, I'm Pete Moore.
And my name's Bex Gregory. And together, we are the co-hosts of the Entertainment Engine podcast. We are really excited to share more information about our show.
The podcast is for new and existing creators working in music, film and TV. Weekly, we provide our listeners with information, advice and knowledge to help people navigate a career in the entertainment industry.
Plus, we have fantastic guests from the world of entertainment who share their stories with us, where we learn from their experience of working in the entertainment business, built in with some fun facts along the way.
So be sure to subscribe on your favourite podcast platform.
You can find us on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Google Podcasts, plus many others.
We look forward to welcoming you to the show.
On this week's episode, we welcome Leland Sklar, who is one of the world's greatest bassists in modern music and has contributed to over 2,000 albums as a session musician, including records by Bette Midler, Reba McEntire, Willie Nelson, Ray Charles, Joe Cocker, The Doors, Rod Stewart, Carole King, The Bee Gees, James Taylor, Dolly Parton and Barbara Streisand, just to name a few. Leland has also played on film soundtracks including Forrest Gump, Ghost, My Best Friend's Wedding and many other TV shows as well. We really hope you enjoy this interview today.
Well, thank you for joining us today on the Entertainment Engine, and we have a really great guest today, all the way from the USA, musician and iconic bass guitarist, Leland Sklar. Leland, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. I only wish I was over there with you talking in person, because I absolutely love the UK and I enjoy every time I get a chance to go over there. And it's been a while now because of the pandemic, so it's at least we get a chance to hang.
Yeah, absolutely. And just, I suppose, just touching on the dreaded word, the pandemic, Leland, how have you been? How have you coped? Have you been safe? Have you had your injections? How have you been dealing with it?
Well, you know, like for everybody else, it was an absolute slap in the face when this hit, and everything you were looking at in your book and your life ahead of you was suddenly put on hold or totally canceled. But I actually ended up making it probably the busiest year I've ever had. It just wasn't real work. But I ended up doing a lot of things that I would have probably never done in my life had it not been for being locked down. And I've had both. I had the Moderna vaccine. I've had both my shots. One of the perks of being old is I got in early on it. And so I've been vaccinated for quite a while, but still being incredibly cautious about things. I'm seeing a lot of people just acting like this never happened, and it scares the hell out of me.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to become cognizant of that this is still, there's still people going in the hospital every day and dying. It's not over. So
I just find it really scary and interesting in both the same sentences, really, Leland.
Yeah.
Because some people just walk around as if was nothing wrong with me and there's nothing going on in the world. I'm like, there's people dying. I mean,
yeah,
I just find it bizarre the way some people's reaction to this has been, really.
I think one of the most shocking things for me in this past year plus was so many people that I thought I really knew, that I thought were really intelligent and creative, interesting people, and you know, musicians I've known who have really drank the Jonestown Kool-Aid about all of this stuff, and they're not going to get vaccinated. They refuse to. They sit there and they say, "I don't know what's in it." And I go, "God, I knew you when you were doing like blow and heroin, and you were an alcoholic, and now you're worried about a vaccination suddenly." So it's a bizarre state that we're all in, but all you can do is do your best in it.
Yeah.
And but the sad part, I don't know what it's like over in the UK, but right now, 98% of the deaths that are from COVID right now are in non-vaccinated people.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we come across quite a lot of people in the UK like it that don't want the sort of vaccination and sort of think, well, I don't want COVID, to be honest with you.
So. Yeah, I mean, the alternative could be potentially catastrophic. And, you know, I think so much of the problem with all of this, and then we can get off the subject because we're preaching to the choir here.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But, you know, so much of this really was the fact that with leaders of countries that are completely incompetent and out of their minds, people buying into the politics, you know, making this a political issue where, you know, I look back at my life and I've had vaccinations for polio and smallpox and diphtheria and shingles and pneumonia. I mean, there's so many that have been available, that so many of these things that were a part of society that were killing so many people are pretty much gone now because of vaccination. And all of a sudden this one comes along and we've got these fools that are making this like some big conspiracy over here. They talk about that Bill Gates is putting chips in each one so he can keep an eye on us. And I'm going, I don't know hardly anybody that I would consider interesting enough for Bill Gates to waste 5 minutes on. I just don't get it, you know. But all my wife and I, we lined up the minute they became available and got it. And I'll tell you, getting it, all of a sudden, it just felt like a weight was lifted off my shoulders about just going to the supermarket.
Yeah, and let alone the supermarket, but obviously, you know, which we discuss as we go through, Lena, but with the live sector.
I mean, they're opening up to concerts here. The thing I don't quite know is how do you control it? Like they're saying, you know, people, you know, you have to be vaccinated to go to it. Well, how do you prove that? Because there's a whole black market of fake COVID cards that say you've been vaccinated, like fake passports and stuff. And even if you socially distance at the gigs and you have, you know, like say you've got an 18,000 seat venue and they're going to only have 9,000 people in it. Well, once the concert starts, if people take their masks off and decide they want to run to the stage, you know, is there going to be fist fights, you know, between security? I mean, I just don't know. I'm getting ready to hit the road on the 20th of this month with Peter Asher.
Okay.
And with Kate Taylor and Albert Lee.
Yeah.
And we're heading back east to do about a little under 2 week run. Now it's all, you know, it's like theater type venues, but still it'll be the first time I've played live since February of last year.
So how do you feel about? I don't know if you've ever been asked this before, but how do you feel about going out live, and how does your wife feel about it? Is she quite happy now that you've been vaccinated? And
I think she's just happy to see me out of the house. I've never been home this long. No. I'm sure every day she kind of walks down and goes, God, he's still here.
Oh. Yeah. It's time to get back on the road. But you still got the buzz and the enthusiasm to get on the road as well, Lean, which I think is great.
Oh, man, totally chomping at the bit. I've got that run, and then I think in September I'm doing a corporate one-off with Lyle Lovett down in Texas, and then at the end of October the immediate family, the band that I'm in, we start working, and we've got some gigs here on the West Coast, and then we fly back and do an East Coast run, and then we're booked on a cruise, a Rock Legends cruise in February out of Florida, and then we'll come back and do some gigs in Florida. So, I mean, you know, the more work I can do, the happier I am. And at this point, having had the vaccine, when I get, you know, on a plane or when I'm going anywhere, I'm still taking a mask with me. And I personally feel safe, but I don't want to take a chance on, you know, anything happening to anybody around me. So I'm trying to be, you know, as cautious as I possibly can be. But I just find it necessary for my heart and soul to get out and play some music.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I think probably my first experience of yourself was probably around 1990 when I went with some of my buddies to see Phil Collins. I wasn't a massive Phil Collins fan, to be honest with you. But I just went along. And I think that was my my sort of first glimpse of you playing the bass guitar. So we did meet, but I was quite far away, to be honest with you.
I thought that was you out there. Yeah, that was the But Serious tour.
Yeah. It was great. Yeah, great. It was a really great gig. And from that point, I was always sort of a great fan of Phil Collins, because he's just a phenomenal artist, and it was just a great gig. So yeah, that was one of my first shows that I went to. So yeah, it was very cool. Oh,
that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
And will you be back doing any shows in the UK any point sort of this year, next year, Leland?
Well, I'm absolutely hopeful, but as of right now, there's nothing in the book. The book is still, being figured out. So it's pretty premature, but there's nothing I would like better than to get back over there. We were supposed to also be in Japan, and we had to postpone that. And we're waiting right now to see when it's, I mean, I don't get it. Japan has only got about an 8% vaccination rate, yet they're going to have the Olympics. So, God knows what's going to happen over there. So, but we're waiting to go back to Japan, and like to get back to Europe too. So we'll see what happens. This is like just baby steps. And I think people are going to be watching all the different events carefully to see what's possible.
Yeah.
And if things start looking like they're working and they're not turning into these super spreader events, and, more and more, strains start to develop, if we can, dodge that bullet, then maybe things will, really actually be viable. But everybody I talk to right now is enthusiastic with an air of trepidation.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah.
Well, I think the one encouragement I think I'll definitely about to give you from the UK is, I don't know if you're a soccer or football fan, but we've just got the European Championships, and the stadiums are sort of opening up, and there seem to be bigger crowds. I think big events like football is quite well controlled, because they can actually, you can access the ground quite easily, and it's all sectioned off. So we know that's been, touch wood, it's been going quite well. So hopefully that could be quite good for, festivals for the following year.
For everything. Yeah. It certainly is a test of humanity getting through this whole thing. And, we're not done yet, so I just don't want people to be naive about this and pretend it's never happened, and we can get right back to whatever you were doing before this hit, because that's a fool's paradise. But I think there's the potential to come out of this with our heads above water. So fingers are crossed. Let's just hope for the best.
Exactly. And just to take you right back to the beginning, Leland, just. Give our listeners a little bit of flavor where you grew up and your early childhood, really. That'd be sort of great to learn.
Well, I was born a very old man, and I seem to have stuck to that. I was actually born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and my family moved to Los Angeles when I was about four and a half years old. So I consider LA my grounds. I consider Wisconsin pretty much, just because I was such a little kid at that point. Always played music. I, when I was 5 years old, I started studying classical piano, and took to it like a duck to water, proverbially, and ended up winning some. By the time I was eight, I had some awards from the Hollywood Bowl Association and stuff. I was really passionate about it, and just studying classics. When I was 12 years old, I went into junior high school, and assuming I would be the piano player, after having had so much smoke blown up my ass for so many formative years, I assumed that would be. And the music teacher said, well, we got plenty of kids play piano. We need a string bass player. And he pulled out an old blonde K upright string bass, and I showed me how to hold it. I plucked one note on that, felt that vibration, and I just said, I'll do it. And never looked back. He gave me some rudimentary lessons on bass, and then I found a teacher. And so all of my early bass work was all on upright, and mostly jazz and classical. I really wasn't, I really didn't enter the world of rock until almost every other player I've ever known, really until the Beatles hit, that suddenly turned my head around completely. And then eventually playing upright in rock bands was a futile effort because there was no such thing as pickups or anything.
So no.
You'd be the guy over there bleeding, trying to be heard while the electric guitar players and keyboard players and drummers were flogging away. And then finally I got in, my dad took me and bought an amp and a bass for me. And I was off and running at that point. I was a contender now.
So your mum and dad were really supportive of you sort of a young age then. So,
yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, it was cool. Very fortunate that I grew up in a first off, a very musical household, not so much as musicians, but as listeners. My parents had a really extensive record collection and in all kinds of genres. So I really got a taste for lots and lots of different music growing up. But they were always really supportive and excited about projects and different things. So
it's funny though, isn't it? When you're growing up and you're surrounded by, you know, different things by your parents, and you know, I was the same with music, and you sort of pay attention to it, but you think, oh, that sounded quite good. But it's only years later that you think, that album was actually really very cool. I didn't realize I listened to that when I was, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And they sort of sit with you for the rest of your life, and they travel with you, don't they? Yeah. Who was your sort of inspiration at a young age? What sort of music did you sort of pick up from your mum and dad?
Certainly a lot of classical. I mean, they really love classical, but they would listen to, they had jazz albums. They would listen to like Martin Denny, you know, which would be almost like really great lounge music.
Yeah.
With a little South Seas attitude in it. Comedy albums, you know, like Red Fox and
guys like
that. So it was very, very eclectic. And the fun of it was always, you know, especially as a kid, a lot of times you would just be digging the albums because the cover was great.
Yeah, exactly.
It was the glorious day of album art.
Yeah.
And so you'd be reading credits and stories, you know, liner notes and all that stuff. So it was very fertile ground for making you enthusiastic about what you were enjoying. And I feel very fortunate that I grew up in that kind of an environment. It's stuck with me to this day.
No, that is very cool. No, it's really good to hear as well. And I think, sort of moving on a little bit, when you sort of carrying on with your studies and your college, was it that time when you met James Taylor, invited you to do some shows and sort of venues?
Yeah, I was in a band in the late. I was always in bands throughout the 60s. Sometimes I was in 3 or 4 bands at a time, and I just love playing. And most of them were cover bands. We would be doing, you know, Beatles songs or the Turtles or, you know, the Birds or, you know, kind of anything. Or we were also like all like really heavy R&B Motown influence. So we would, you know, be trying to do, you know, Major Lance and Al Green songs and stuff. But in the late 60s, around 68, 69, I was in a band called Wolfgang. And actually, two of the members of Wolfgang were from the UK. One who's still working all the time is Bryn Haworth.
Okay, yeah.
And Bryn's a fabulous guitarist, wonderful singer, writer. And then he pursued more of, I think, an evangelical journey musically. And that's what he does. And the drummer in our group was Bugs Pemberton, who was in Jackie Lomax and The Undertakers. Back in England, and they moved to LA, and we ended up forming this band. And it gets a little convoluted because Bugs had a really dear friend named John Fishbeck, and John Fishbeck owned Crystal Recording Studios, and he did like the early Stevie Wonder records, like Songs in the Key of Life and all that stuff. And John used to come and hang out. We ended up renting a house as a band where we would rehearse, and a couple of the guys lived there. I didn't live with them, but we were playing all the time. And John would come and hang out at our rehearsals because he became friends with everybody. And at one of our rehearsals in the late 69, he brought a friend of his who had just come back from England, who had just cut an album over there. And it was James Taylor. And James hung out at our rehearsals for a couple of days, and we hit it off really good. But I was still in college. I was still, you know, deep in studies and stuff. But James came back and cut the album Sweet Baby James just before we met. And he got offered a gig at the Troubadour here in Los Angeles. And they had the band was intact except for a bass player. They had James's oldest friends, Danny Korchmar, playing guitar, Cooch, Russ Kunkel playing drums, and Carol King playing piano. And they needed a bass player, and James remembered me from this rehearsal, and he was produced and managed by Peter Asher, and he told Peter about me, and they tracked me down and basically offered me a show to play. And that was kind of it. And I said, yeah, sure. I mean, I was, you know, in school and everything. And we played this gig, and the next thing you know, James is on the cover of Time magazine as the voice of an entire new movement in music. And they said, we're going to go back and play there again. And the minute we played there, they got offered a tour. And I just walked out of school and never graduated, never went back, told anybody I was leaving. And we hit the road. And that one gig basically laid the groundwork for the entire rest of my life.
Wow. I mean, that's mega, isn't it? That?
Yeah. I mean, it's really, yeah, it's crazy. But and the thing that was, there was a whole bunch of like perfect storm things that happened. It was a time where, at least here on the West Coast, certainly they were ready for something new.
Yeah.
We were lucky that Peter Asher was one of the very first producers that insisted that the musicians on the album's names appear on the album. On the jacket of the album, because like with the Wrecking Crew and all those people, you know, people would be at home listening to the Mamas and the Papas and the Beach Boys and Frank Sinatra and all these different records, not knowing that it was the same musicians playing on all these things, because they never got credit. But Peter had our names on it. So with the advent of the singer-songwriter movement that came out of James, people could look at James's records and they would see my name and Cooch and Russ and all of us, and they would go, well, man, if it's good enough for James Taylor, it's got to be good enough for Jackson Browne and yeah. Linda Ronstadt. And the next thing, I had only been in a recording studio one time as a musician before suddenly starting this career. And that was with Wolfgang. We ended up cutting some demos up in San Francisco with David Rubinson producing.
Okay.
And that was it. Other than that, I had no clue about studio etiquette, how you get a sound. And all of a sudden, I was called every day to work. And we were doing sometimes 3-4 sessions a day, 6 days a week. So we went from basically, it was like, it would be like driving a Top Fuel dragster as compared to like a Volkswagen. You know, we went from 0 to 100 in a second. and really were learning on the job what the hell we were doing. And the good thing for me was, as it evolved, I had this history of having come from classical music, so I already had reading chops, I was the guy in the group that was getting access to other kinds of sessions, where the other guys weren't really strong readers, so I was getting movie calls and television calls and jingles and other dates that were more defined in terms of having to read charts and things like that. And so it's been the weirdest journey imaginable, because it was completely unintentional. It was a complete accident. I mean, a perfect storm of meeting James being the guy for this new movement, and each of us having the goods for what was needed. Because, you know, you could get offers and opportunities, but if you don't have what's required of you as a player, you won't get the gig. So we were very lucky that whatever abilities we had, sound, technique, style, all that fit perfectly for what was needed for this new movement. And suddenly we became like the vanguard of a new movement. And it was weird for me, because I'm suddenly working with James Taylor, who's really known as far more of a mellow kind of, you know, balladeer and stuff, even though James could really rock the house when he felt like it. But that wasn't the image they were portraying. And like when I came out of the bands I was in, like Wolfgang and the couple of bands I was in before that, we were totally like hard rock bands. I mean, the first gig we ever played with Wolfgang was opening for Zeppelin at Winterland in 1968.
Oh, wow.
We had never been on stage, even in a club before. And all of a sudden there we were sharing the stage with Zeppelin.
Wow.
So it's been a really interesting journey, to say the least.
Well, see, this is why, Leland, that Becky and myself, when we was sort of back in lockdown last year, we was thinking, well, what else can we do regarding, you know, what we do within our company? And we thought, well, actually, why don't we look at a podcast? Because, you know, it's a good thing to do, and we wasn't sure what was going to happen, and we thought, oh, we'll give it a go and put something together. And the one thing that I think I would take with me, and I know Becky will with herself as well, is we're documenting people's sort of life stories on audio. And I think that's really cool, because you can look back in 10 years' time and say, well, have a listen to this, what Leland done. Look at what he did there and how he started. And I think for new musicians and new creatives coming through, I think it's just a wealth of knowledge for people just to plug into. And I think, and also leaving something behind it as a, this is what we've provided in the entertainment industry, and this is sort of like our, I suppose, our contribution, really.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that's why this has been such a double-edged sword during this period, because on the one hand, it's a horrible time in our history. The amount of deaths and misery, the people losing their homes, their businesses, families falling apart.
Yeah,
I mean, so many negatives. But on the flip side of that, there's been some amazingly positive things, like this, that would have never happened had it not been for this. If everybody was on the same path they were on, I mean, I had enough work lined up for this past year and a half where I wouldn't have had time to do any of the stuff that I've done in this period. I've tried to be creative every single day, and I've absolutely ended up doing things that I never dreamed I would be doing. And I'm loving it. I'm still enjoying it.
Well, yeah, and your experience of what you've done, and, you know, working with James and working with, you know, going on to like Carol and Phil Collins and Linda Ronstadt, you know, I think that's just really great advice and knowledge, and just for people to plug into and go, well, Leland's done it. You know, there's no reason why you can't do it.
If he can do it, anybody can.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you is, I mean, I've got a little beard, but your beard is fantastic, phenomenal. I mean, how long have you had it sort of like that?
Well, I keep it in a box next to me, and I get up every morning and glue it on, you know. Now, when I went to high school, it was in the middle of the 60s. It was fairly repressive. They would have teachers that were like grooming guards, and
guys, you
couldn't have facial hair. I mean, I go by schools now and I see guys with beards and long hair.
Oh, yeah.
No way that would ever happen back then. So when they handed me my high school diploma and I graduated in 65, I said, screw this, I'm done. But I cut it all the time, just because it got to a point where I was longer and it was getting caught in like my strap locks
and all that.
So I had to like use my bass as kind of a guide as to where I needed to stop. But I was, you know, I come from Russian Polish stock, so that kind of Eastern European and all that. So like when I was like, you know, from like 13 years old or so, I actually started shaving. I didn't have a big beard, but I started shaving. And when summers would come, I would kind of grow some kind of a beard. And nobody expected that. So I was able to go play like adult jazz clubs and stuff, and never got, you know, said, well, you're too young to be in here kind of situation. I might have been 14 or 15 years old and playing at the Lighthouse or these clubs that had 21-year-old, you know, things. And then I would have to cut it off when I went back to school. So I just kind of kept it. And then it suddenly became like a calling card.
Well, I certainly say it's a statement.
You know, like, you know, like looking at Billy Gibbons and the guy and William Golden from the Oaks and, you know, lots of guys. So, you know, it's a follicular community.
Now, like you say, everyone now has got a beard, haven't they, in the last sort of 10 years. I mean, I've had one for probably since I was 30, I think I just kept mine. And yeah, but I think it's certainly, yours is certainly a statement. If it's, people see you on stage and perform it, they're going to remember you 100%. Absolutely. You
know, so many times they don't know who I am, but they go, oh, it's that guy with the beard. You know, kind of situation. And then I see all these things, like when I'm looking at like Toto videos, you know, from the tours I did with them, and everybody's, you know, Gandalf on bass, oh, Santa Claus on bass. Oh, you know, they like every movie that's come along, you know, that has anybody with a beard in it, I suddenly become that person, you know, in the comment section, in the chat windows. So it's all pretty silly. But it's just, but the thing is, man, I can't go through a day where you don't get stopped by somebody who recognizes you. I'll be sitting, it's really funny, I'll be sitting at like the music center, like going to see a play or something, and I see somebody, I can tell they're Googling, and I see my picture pop up on their phone because they're trying to make sure I'm who they think it is that's sitting a couple of rows back. You know? See, I'm also very fortunate, though, from the standpoint that with all this recognizability, I've always been a side man. So people aren't freaking out when they see me. I get people that just come and go, oh, man, I saw you with Phil Collins or blah, blah, blah. Man, what a great show. You know, the stuff you played on is like the soundtrack of my life. Where I've seen them when they would come up to Phil Collins and they're crapping their pants and, you know, and they're almost fainting. So I don't get that kind of response from people. So for me, it's really quite comfortable. We can break into a conversation immediately, have a nice little conversation, and then we're done. And it's so sitting as a side man, you're in a whole different relationship with the fan base.
Yeah, and one of the chaps that I worked with for a long time, he's just outside London. He's got a small recording studio, and I think actually you would actually really like it, Leland. It's an analog studio. It's like quarter inch tape, reel to reel.
Nice.
And he's really, really cool. He's one of the best recording studios I've ever worked with and sort of been around. And it's, you know, one of those, it's under like a railway arch. So it's very dark and dreary as you go in, but then the equipment's just fantastic. And some of the bands that have gone through there, no one really, really famous, but there's just some great acts that have gone through, sort of metal bands, rock bands, punk bands. And honestly, Leland, the sound that comes out of that studio is probably still the best that I've ever heard across the world, because the musicians are really good. And that's one thing I was going to ask you, is the amount of session musicians I've seen come in and go and just turn up and perform. I think there's more pressure on you guys than the actual band, because they've got to deliver, and the band just delivers all of the time because it's what they do. But when you're coming in as a session, I feel there's more pressure on a session musician, because you could only be there for an afternoon or a couple of days and you're gone, and you've just got to deliver that, you know, there and then.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a fun job, but it is absolutely stressful. And I have always looked at it as every time I take a session with somebody, when I show up, in my mind, I've joined that band or that in that artist's band. It's not just hired help. And so you're really coming in, digging your heels in as though this is your one and only project. And you might walk out the door after it's done and never see those people again. You may never even hear what you worked on, but you want to leave having been really proud of what you've contributed to this project.
And
it's really an adventure every day, because I would say probably at least 80% of what I've been hired to work on, I had no idea what it was going to be before I showed up at work.
No.
Even stylistically, it could be country, it could be reggae, it could be, you know, jazz, it could be rock. You just don't know most of the time. And you show up, you don't know necessarily who the other players are going to be on the date. And you might show up and you suddenly go, oh, man, I am in my comfort zone, because you're looking around and it's the guys you work with all the time. And there's other times you walk in and I'll meet a drummer who I've never played with.
Yeah.
So beyond doing the recording, you suddenly have to do this quick dance together to figure out where the pocket is, where you know, where that guy's lace is, backbeat, and all that stuff. So it's a very fast and furious process in many ways. But that's kind of also the thing that's kept it fascinating to me, is that there is that unknown every single day. I might be doing basically the same job every day in terms of I've got the same equipment and my setup is the same, but what I'm going to be doing with that, it's not like working at like a car manufacturing plant, and even though at this point most of it's robotic, but you know, having that one job where you're doing, you know, like you're putting the hub on the end of the axle. But for me, it's like it would be like having that job, but every day they're sending you a different car that's set up differently, so you're having to kind of do the same job, but you're having to readjust your thinking every time something rolls in front of you.
And it keeps it fresh and like interesting, like you say.
I've been doing this, other than this past year, I mean, I've been doing this almost daily for, you know, a half a century, and it's never been boring. I've never taken it for granted, never get tired of it. I was really depressed this morning. I just got a call to do an album project. I haven't worked on a real album project now in a year and a half. Call me for 5 days of work, and it's the days that I'm going to be out with Peter Asher. So all of a sudden I've been sitting in my ass for a year and a half, and all of a sudden all the work's coming in for the same time. And it's like doing this with you, and then after this I do a live stream twice a month for my YouTube channel. Yeah. And the minute that's over, I have a session tonight. And so I've got like a packed day.
I think it's called what's the term, Leland? Sod's Law, something like that, where everything all just comes at once or it never happens at all. And
we always kind of call it like feast or famine.
exactly. And I think looking back and everything that you've done and working with sort of Jackson Browne and Carole King and obviously Phil Collins and Linda Ronstadt, this might be quite a difficult one, Leland, but which one stands out most to you, whoever you've worked with? Who's the one that you go, that was really cool and I'd love to do that again?
I'll tell you, one of my favorite albums I ever played on, and I still, it feels as fresh today as the day we cut it, was Billy Cobham's Spectrum.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We did that album in 1973, and if when I listen to it now, it feels as strong and powerful as it did. And we did that whole album in 2 days.
Wow.
It's almost all first takes on that. And I had gotten to know Billy because we had, in the early 70s, we had a band called The Section that was the backup band for James Taylor and Jackson Browne and stuff. Yeah. But we were like a rock fusion band. And we spent 6 weeks on the road opening for Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Okay.
And so we all became friends, and breaks my heart that the great Rick Laird just passed away this past week. But Billy and I became friends, and he asked me if I would, he said, I got a record deal. You want to play on my record? And when I showed up, I had been used to hanging with he and Jan Hammer on the road. But the thing that blew my mind was going into the studio, Electric Lady Studios in New York.
Yes.
And there's Tommy Bolin on guitar. And when I was in Wolfgang, Tommy Bolin was in Zephyr, and we were managed by the same company. So we spent time on the road together. And so that kind of blew my mind. But, you know, there's so many in so many different genres, and that there's so many that have really been kind of benchmark records. Certainly, you know, playing like, I loved like Jackson's first album, you know, with Doctor My Eyes and stuff. It was just a magic, because at that point, especially like the first James Taylor records, first Jackson and all that, it was like guerrilla recording. I mean, none of us really quite knew what the hell we were doing, so we were kind of making our rules as the days went on. And so I have fond memories about so much of that. But then, you know, when I'd be in the studio and I'd put my headphones on and be listening to Barbara Streisand in the vocal booth singing, you know, and you're just kind of going, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. It's been a little of everything. And I think really for me, it's the wonderful variety of people that I've gotten to play with that's really made this all interesting. And so many of them were really just unique and wonderful experiences. And the thing that's great is they're still happening. You know, when I'll walk in the studio with some new artist and I just walk, I go out to the parking lot afterwards, getting in my truck, and I just go, God, that was good, man. They are really,
really, really good.
And so I'm really appreciative. And I, for me, I think also so much of this is the community of the players, not so much the artists. That, you know, when I sit and I think about the blessing in my life to have played with, you know, most of the great drummers that I could ever have ever imagined in the world. So, I mean, you know, I can run the gamut from Lee Von Helm to Vinnie Colaiuta, you know, to Jeff Porcaro, to Russ Kunkel. And, and all these guys were all friends. It's such a really beautiful community that's incredibly supportive of each other.
Yeah, and I think that, again, I've sort of experienced some of that as well, Lee, and I think that is, you know, a really cool thing to do. And I also think as well, how do you, when you go into record, do you always think the first recording you do is the best one that you've done? Because do you think there's too much of trying to perfect the song now, perfect the session, where you go in and you'll just be yourself and do the first, you know, the first take, and it's the best one that you've done? Because you look back on the end of the day and go, well, actually, that was really cool.
Yeah. Once again, I always look at everything that I've really ever done is predicated on the song. And each song has its own different requirements and different needs. So there are times when you go in and the song just lays itself out in front of you. And man, that the first time you play it, you're not thinking about it yet. And especially, I'm always appreciative if I'm doing a project, I can at least, I don't necessarily want a written out, you know, transcription of what they want me to do.
No.
Unless it's something that's absolutely demands that kind of a thing, like doing TV and movies and things like that. But having a chord sheet so that I don't have to necessarily be thinking about the changes as much as what I'm going to do with them on the first run through. And it usually is that first response, or maybe the second one. That's where really the magic all happens. And after that, you can start to get a little mechanical with it, unless the song is really complicated and really requires some dissemination, or it's really incomplete. There's so many times you show up and the artist is at the piano or a guitar, and they're playing a song. They haven't thought about a bridge or an intro or things like that. So some of the early energy is really the band helping construct the song for the artist. Because a lot of times you're dealing with an artist who's never played with other musicians, and they have no idea. They've never had to, you know, be restricted in terms of tempo and things. So. And you're suddenly going, look, we cut a drummer here. We've got, you know, let's keep this thing in a pocket. And some of your energy is just getting that artist to maybe remove some of the stuff they're used to doing, being a solo artist and trying to cover everything by themselves, and making room now to have a band playing with them, or just being able to put this thing in more of a pocket. Because they've never really thought that way before, not working with other players. So there's so many criteria that come into play. But to get back to the original question was, a lot of times if everything's laid out right, certainly that very first take is probably going to be the one that's going to be the one where you're just going to kind of use that as your reference point as you slog through the rest of the day up to like take 45. And you're just saying, could we go back and listen to the first one or second one again, please?
Have you found sometimes when you're in the studio and it's a new artist and a new band that you're sort of pulled on a lot more because of your experience? They look to you to actually maybe bring the song together and a lot more structure, or say, Leland, what would you do here? You sort of been in that position quite a lot?
Yeah. And at times there's a part of that that's a little annoying, because sometimes their expectations are that you're going to, because of what you've played on, you're going to make their thing sound like, you know, the thing that they most, and you're kind of going, look at, you're not James Taylor. You're not writing songs like James Taylor. I mean, I'm going to do the best I can, but sometimes their expectation is really high and you're sort of feeling like, I wonder if I'm like disappointing these people because they're expecting some kind of incredible magic to happen in my department. And none of this is requiring me to do anything more than I'm doing. So there are times like that where the expectations are high and it's really, it's hard to live up to what somebody thinks because they've painted an image of their mind of what you do because of all the stuff they've listened to.
Yeah.
But the things that they've listened to maybe are a whole lot more interesting musically and better than what they're giving you to work with. And you can just, a lot of times we all laugh at each other and we just call ourselves turd polishers. And at the end of the day, you know, it might be shiny and you can see your face in it, but it's still a turd. You just don't know. So it's all predicated on the individual song and you build from that point.
Yeah, exactly. And I think looking at all the artists there are today, Leland, is there any new artist that you'd want to work with today and why? Is there anyone that sort of stands out to you at the moment?
It's really hard for me to say names. I hear stuff that I go, this is great, but the format that I grew up with listening to radio was you would hear a song and they would say who it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now, God, sometimes you listen to these incredibly long playlists on the radio and they never credit who the hell the artists are. Or by the time they do, you have no idea. And I'm busy enough where I don't sit and go through, you know, listening online. For me, my musical joy was always the act of sitting in with a turntable and putting a record on and experiencing it all. And at this point, so much of that is just not there. So I hear things and I go, God, that would be a fun project to work on, or that person's really cool. But at the end of the day, I have no idea who they are.
No.
Unless maybe I hear it again and I can suss it out.
Yeah. No, that's fair enough. And with your work, Lena, do you have an agent now? Does work just generally come to you? Do people just pick up the phone to you? How does it work?
I've never had an agent, never had a manager. Everything's been directly, people just call me and we book the date and settle on everything and that's it.
And it's worked well? Does that work well for you? Obviously
it
has.
Well, it worked for me. I mean, I know a bunch of guys that have managers if I had a manager, I might have more things going on, but I really, at this point, I've never really felt I wanted more things going on. I've always had a good balance between studio and road. And home. And so, you know, I might have been able to be more successful in what I do had I had somebody doing that. Or I remember I was working with a bunch of guys and we were going to do a tour in Japan and they all had the same manager and I didn't have a manager. And the Japanese people contacted that manager to set up a deal with the other guys. And the manager agreed to it. And then when the Japanese contacted me, I said, absolutely not. I said, that is unacceptable. And I told them what I needed, but it was a favored nations situation.
So
they ended up giving everybody what they were giving me, which was fine. And the other guys, when I talked to them, they said, man, I don't know why the hell you don't go with our manager. Check out what he got us. And I went, check this out. I said, he sold you down the river. I got us that. And you really should be giving me each 20% of what you're making because I got you the deal. He didn't. And they were all completely shocked at it.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point because I think there's so many things now artists can do for themselves where, you know, you don't need an agent or a manager. There's so many things you can set up your website and your merch and you can start doing your shows. You know, and there's lots of, and you're a testament to that. So there's lots of things you can do. Well, sometimes I think all of that gets in the way. It can be a bit of a hindrance because, you know, it's just another sort of tick box that you need to tick. And again, you got a better deal than what the manager got because the manager sold the band down the river. And how many times have we heard that?
Well, I think also, this is, once again, this is, everybody's an individual. There's guys I know that absolutely don't want to deal with anything except let me know where to be and what time to be there.
Don't want to
have to deal with anything. Where for me, I could have always been the tour manager on tours I was on, because I'm that real type A ADHD kind of a personality, where I'm like, I can really take care of details and sort things out and get things done where other guys don't want to know about it.
No.
But that's not me being right and them being wrong. It's just everybody deals with life in their own ways. So I've just always felt, you know, comfortable just taking care of what I've got to do. And that's where I ended up this year doing this book that I did. I've ended up doing this YouTube channel, which has really been going kind of great. I think today will be my 651st video since March of last year. I've not missed a day yet, which I'm really freaking out over, because the stuff coming up with Peter is going to actually conflict a little bit, like with my live stream and stuff. And it'll be the first time I've actually had to adjust my schedule in this year and a half. But everybody on my network is going, we're just happy you're working. We'll figure it all out. Don't worry about it kind of situation. Yeah. I'd never recorded at home before the pandemic. If people wanted, you know, send me files or something, I would go over to, I've got a couple, you know, a bunch of friends with really great home studios, and I would just go to their house, put a bass track on, and then we'd go out to lunch, kind of used to this as a social life.
And then all
of a sudden in lockdown, that didn't happen. And I had a friend contact me about playing on a track for him. And I said, I am not set up. I have nothing to do. I don't know anything about this shit. And next thing I know, he had friends at SSL, and they ended up sending me an SSL 2+ interface.
Okay.
And Steve Postel, who's one of the guys in our band, he's got a home studio. And I called him on the phone, and for my needs, I don't need anything more than GarageBand. I don't need to have Pro Tools or anything like that. So he just talked me through it, and I've ended up doing a whole bunch. I did a thing for Julian Lennon's new album. I've just finished three songs for Ian Pace. There's a guy in Ireland. I did his album and another project from New Zealand. And so I've got three things sitting here right now that I need to make charts for and start working on. So, I mean, it's like, it's been a year of all kinds of things that I had never done before. But it got me through the year in terms of still feeling viable.
One thing I wanted to ask, because I've sort of heard you on a few other podcasts as well, which I found really interesting, was you've embraced technology. And how have you found YouTube? You've sort of, you know, 650-odd shows is mad. That's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, without trying, I mean, I've got 158,000 people on my channel. And what I do is, because the way it started was when we finished Phil Collins's last tour, the Not Dead Yet tour.
Yeah.
I had some guys writing to me, like from Europe and from South America, that had seen the shows like in stadiums. And they were going, man, the show is unbelievable. The sound's amazing, because our front of house guy is one of the best I ever worked with, Michel Collin.
We couldn't hear
some of the details because, you know, in a venue that size, bass, you know, can suffer for it.
Yes.
And so I contacted Michel, and he sent me a couple of shows, board mixes of a couple of shows. And the one from Adelaide, Australia, was real good. And so what I did is I loaded it into my laptop, plugged in a little Bose speaker into the headphone jack. I'm still using an old MacBook Pro that still actually has ports in it that you could do things with. Nurturing this thing along. And then I've got my little Euphonic amp on the floor next to me. So what I did was I decided to start with the first song of Phil's show and play along. But I've done my entire show is on my iPhone. And so what I do is I just set the iPhone up and I played with it a bit to where when I'm playing the track, it's a little bit quieter than the bass amp. So you can hear every bass note. So I was using it just to show them bass parts. And by the third song of the show, I did one every day. And by the third day and the third song, I had people writing going, man, we love your YouTube channel. And I go, what are you talking about? And they go, your new channel. And I go, I have no idea what you're talking about. I was just posting some songs to, and it suddenly turned into this other animal. And so I finished Phil's, I did all the stuff. I ran the whole show. The only thing I didn't play was Take Me Home. I figure when I'm going to finally end this channel years from now, whatever, I'll do Take Me Home as like the ultimate last video. But I got through the show and then I went, well, shit, now what? So I started digging archivally. I went into All Music and started looking at old projects I'd worked on and like N Jackson. And so I showed the bass part to Dr. My Eyes, and I went through, you know, most of the Billy Cobham stuff and played Stratus and, you know, Red Baron and all this thing. And it just, I got into doing this every day. And then and I became friends with Rick Beato, who's kind of one of the kings of YouTube channels, and yep. Tim Pierce.
Yeah.
And yep. And ended up setting up a clubhouse for the channel. And so I do like two to two and a half hour live stream, and there's a couple of hundred people that come on that each time. And then once a month I do a one-on-one either FaceTime or Skype for about 15 minutes per person, and I do about 20 people that day. And you know, everybody's become like great friends, and during a period of lockdown, it's become a remarkable community. And like today, when I log in to do my thing, I'll kind of watch the chat window for like, I open it up early, and man, all these people are talking to each other. How are you doing? How's the family? What's going on? And before I even get involved in it. And it's really fascinating to me. So I've always enjoyed YouTube. I mean, to me, it's almost shocking at times, the things I can find on there that I was working on. And I'm going, I never saw anybody in that studio with a camera. Where's this footage from?
Yeah,
kind of thing.
I know.
Especially things that are really old, you know, where you didn't have like a phone you could film with.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing to me, but I really enjoy it. And I find it a really great format. And one of the things that I've been asked for decades, you got to do a book, man. You got to do a book. I've never really wanted to do one of those books because I've seen a million of them by other players. I kind of feel like I'm doing an audio history of my career and the music I've lived through, because each video is another song for the most part. And I'm talking about, and I've only done stuff I've played on. And so I talk about the studio, who was on the tracks, who produced it, you know, what year we did this, what was going on, and if there's any backstories. So I'm actually documenting the thing I think that is meaningful in my career, talking about being a little kid growing up and all that. That's okay. But to me, the essence I want to leave behind is just a musical footprint. And so this channel's really kind of become that, and I'm sort of using that as a legacy thing, like we talked about earlier.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that.
Oh, it's fun when I read comments and people are like writing in, like after I've done like one of the songs I've done, they're going, I've been listening to this song my whole life. I can't believe I'm actually talking to the guy that played on it and stuff like that. And it's really fun. I mean, it really kind of takes down that wall that can exist between, you know, artist and fan. I've never liked that. Like when we would be on tour, like with James Taylor playing like the big summer sheds or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Where most of the guys are all down, you know, downstairs in the dressing room waiting for the show. I go out and walk around the lawn and talk to people out there, sit down, maybe eat some fried chicken with a family and just, you know, and hang out. And I've always loved the interaction with people. I've never really felt there was this huge separation between us. We're all people in this together. I mean, we're here for a short time, so let's kind of enjoy it.
I think it also makes a better experience as well, Lynn, because I think when you've gone out and done that and you've spoken to the people at the show, they go out and buy the album and they also walk away and say, he was really cool. He was actually really cool. And that's what happens. And I think, to be honest with you, that's probably the best comment you can ever get. because I think some artists don't really understand, not just artists, but I think a lot of people don't understand that mechanic. I think you've got to be able to interact and just sort of have a conversation. I think if you can do that, then that's a positive thing.
I totally agree with that. I mean, it's a whole other level of relationship. And I've worked with a lot of artists who wouldn't give a fan the time of day. They would shove them out of their way. Like when they're going to the bus, they didn't want to be bothered. They would not take a picture. They won't do anything. And I just go, you're really missing one of the best parts of this entire. Now, every once in a while, of course, there's going to be kind of the lunatic that's going to show up at teams, and you've got to be cognizant of that. Yeah. But it's a rarity. And for me, I just always have enjoyed the hang with people. I love meet and greets after shows. When you know you've played your show and you're winding down, well, go sit at a table. You know, you can sell some swag. And take pictures with people, and it becomes this really complete experience for you and for art and for the audience.
Well, yeah, I agree. I can 1,000% agree with that. And I think you know a lot of the artists I've worked with, and you know, especially with you know my business partner Beck, she's a sort of country pop rock female singer songwriter, and she's really good with people. She's really good with on stage, and when she comes off, she has a conversation and. I think that's really important because for me, going to a festival or going to a concert and, you know, that person gets interaction with that artist, they not only become a fan of that artist, but I think you've sort of hit the nail on the head. They've had the experience, you know, of that event, walking away going, that was really cool and I thoroughly enjoyed that. And that person, their idol that they've met, has left a great mark on them for the rest of their life. And I think a lot of people, to use your word, Leland, they miss a trick. Yep. They don't understand that mechanic and they just think they're going to be on stage playing in front of 50,000 people. Well, no, you're not, because I know lots of bands that play in front of 5 people, sometimes none, but still manage to deliver a performance and still will sit at the bar afterwards and have a conversation with people and they've achieved a lot.
Yeah, I'm one of my favorite people I've been working with the past number of years is Judith Owen. And Judith is married to Harry Shearer from Spinal Tap and all that. She's amazing. And I remember we were doing a UK run and we were up in like the Lakes region and playing in a pub. And there was probably like 30 people there. And I had a couple of guys come up to me and they go, holy crap, last time I saw you were like in Wembley Stadium. What are you doing here? I said, I'm playing music. Are you having a good time? And they went, yeah. I said, done. We're good. I said, it doesn't always have to be the stadium gigs. You know, to me, some of the best gigs I've ever played were sound checks.
Yes.
You looked out and maybe there was some ushers from like a venue that were sitting there and you looked out and they were dancing to your sound check and nobody was, nothing was on display at that point. You were just going for it and having fun. And so to me, you know, I'm appreciative of any gig. I could care less if you're playing, you know, for 300,000 people at the Rock in Rio Festival, or if you're playing in somebody's backyard for a birthday party. If you're playing, you're doing what you love, and that's it. Now the business people that are involved, they might, you know, have a whole different spin on it. They want to do as big a gig as you can get and maximize the dough and all that. But as a player, man, I'm happy to play anywhere. You know, I can sit here and just play working on people's projects and stuff. And I'm having a good time. And when I do the YouTube thing, most, at this point, I would say 60% of it, I play along with, and 40% or so. I just listen along with everybody else because I explain to them, I said, like on Gene Clark's No Other album, On the track No Other, I think I have 6 basses on it. They kind of let me run with that track, and I've got all kinds of bass parts on it. And I said, it's impossible to reproduce this. Plus, something I did where the band just locked in 1976, I'm not going to be able to sit here and do that, but I can be fanboy, and I'm not just sitting here scrutinizing bass parts. I said, I'd like to just listen along with you and expose you. And so many people write to me and they just go, I never even heard of this project and I've already ordered it. And man, this is amazing. Yeah. And, you know, and to me, I'm using it as almost like a music education course, explaining as much about music as I possibly can, and the process and who's involved in it. And I feel validated doing this because of the responses that I get from the people that have joined the clubhouse and come to the live stream and the conversations we have. It's been a valuable experience.
No, it is. And I think looking at that, if you could change anything about the entertainment industry, Leland, what would it be? What's the one thing you would change?
It's really hard to say it, but man, I would love to be rid of things like Live Nation and stuff. It's become such business where there's shows I would like to go see, but I'm not going to pay $300 to $500 for a crap seat to see a show, you know, and then the scalpers are out there at, you know, $1,500 or something for a seat. I'm just kind of weary of that. I think, you know, I see a lot squandered in this, but it's the things I kind of miss is in the days when I started in this was almost all labels, and you knew from the get-go you were going to get sort of screwed by the label, but the label had a machinery in place to get you on the radio, to get you, you know, artist development and things like that. Which there's so many great projects that I've worked on that when we finish them, the artist kind of goes, God, any idea what we can do now? I mean, there's no blueprint for where you go. And so many things are privately, you know, somebody made a bunch of money in high tech or something and always wanted to have something to do with the music business. So they're willing to, you know, throw 10 grand or, you know, 20 grand into making an album for somebody. And at the end of the day, though, all you've got is an album, but you have no idea what to do with it. And it could be wonderful. Yeah. So there's a lot of aspects of this business that would be nice to change. Whether or not they'll ever change, I don't know. But there is that whole thing where there is that bit of a chasm when you use the word music and then you use the word music business. It can really get in the way a lot of times.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's been a lot of my experience when, you know, I started out working at labels and, you know, one of them got sold and I sort of built festivals for 20 years and I see both sides of it, Lee. Yeah. And it is quite difficult for me. And you're sort of raising money on one hand. So you've got to appease the investors and you've got to make them happy. But on the other hand, you've got to, you know, provide the creativity. And I think the Live Nations of the world and all the big promoters, they have sort of sucked it dry to a point, because I still say the best gigs that I've ever gone to, even if it's a big festival, it's normally the obscure tent that's 6 miles up the road that you would never normally go into. And it's the unsigned band that's just been together for 3 weeks or even 2 days, and they just create something phenomenal. And, you know, people go to, you know, festivals and they want to see the big headline artist, and, you know, I get that, but I still think you've got to find that gem of an act that sits in the corner somewhere that never gets the opportunity. And I also think record companies over the years, they've missed a lot of tricks. They've spent millions of dollars on marketing. They've chucked it at the wall and half of it just doesn't work. And it is difficult. And I think there's a lot of talent in the world that's never going to be found or even heard because of that problem.
I agree totally.
It's difficult, but you know, we got to keep moving forward. You know, we just got to keep doing that. And I think for new people coming into the industry, what piece of advice would you give them today? You got a young band or a young artist in front of you. What's a solid piece of advice you would give them?
Run away as fast as you can. Get the hell out of here. it's really hard to say because, you know, there's so much that comes into play in terms of the genre they're working in, how popular that is maybe at the moment, the personalities within the band, because sometimes you end up with some of the newbies that come along that have the worst egos you have to deal with.
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, just, you know, you try to find people you get along with musically and socially, where you can be together and not be fighting and arguing all the time. And try to just enjoy whatever happens. Keep your, you know, that's the problem I find with shows like American Idol and The Voice and, you know, Britain's Got Talent, America's Got Talent, whatever. Any of these shows, you get all these people on there that have basically gone from loading dock to theoretically superstar without having really paid any dues in the middle. And so they have this weird expectation of how this works, and everybody starts to think that that's how the music business works. Where I think it was Dave Grohl said, you know, just find a bunch of cats you love playing with and lock up in a garage and play as much as you can. You just never know. Yeah. Like when I met James, I mean, that was a whole different time. But now I had no expectation that I was going to be in the music business. I was a science and art major in school. And I thought I had a whole a complete other direction going on. So you go in and do the best you can. But one thing I would say is never say no, because you just don't know what could be around the corner. Now, you might say yes to doing something that sucks. So if you get asked to do it again, then you say no. But there are so many times where I'll, like, you know, even at this point still, like, find myself walking into a situation where I could have, like, blown it off. It didn't seem like a big deal, but I kind of went, hey, man, I might meet a player there where I'm going, oh, man, we got to play more and let's do something together. And or somebody's there at you're playing some funky gig and somebody's there who's just going, man, I just did a TV show. You guys would be perfect for the theme song of the show. You just never know. Now, nothing may ever happen for you, too. It is an incredibly competitive industry that for every person that makes it in this, there's thousands behind them that aren't going to make it. So you have to be ready for, you know, disappointment and things. But you can also go on and play music all your life. I've done a lot of projects with people that thought they were going to start in the music business and realized it was going to be too hard for what they were thinking it was going to be, and went off and had careers in other industries and were really successful at it. And they came back and self-financed their albums after that. And some of them are some of the best albums I've ever worked on, but nobody's ever going to hear them. These people had just the passion never left. And they finally found an opportunity to do what they dreamed of.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I think that's cool as well. I don't think it, I think it's going back to, you know, what Dave Grohl said is just get a bunch of guys, you know, get into a garage and just play, I think, is the best thing. Because I think a lot of bands, if you hone your craft and you just want to go and do a great live performance and continue to do that, then things would come from that anyway. Yeah. Because people go, well, that's a great performance. I think you need to be on my show. And it have a ripple effect. And I don't think that's a bad thing either, really, to be honest.
But a lot of people go into this with the expectation that they're going to be, you know, they're going to get started playing, and then 2 weeks later, they're going to be looking at the new BMW catalog. You know, dude, man, it does not happen that way.
No. I mean, I think we've all got stories, you know, of that situation. And now you're absolutely right. It just doesn't work that way. And I think one of the biggest things for me is people's expectations. It's really difficult to manage them sometimes, Leland, because you think, okay, you might think you're going to walk into this big label, but, you know, you don't know what's going to come out of it, sure. But 9 times out of 10, it's not what you think it's going to be, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
It's crazy.
It is difficult. So just think about this, Leland. You're going to dinner, and what 3 people would you have join you for a dinner party? Who would they be?
Well, first off, I think the first person would be the one who usually picks up the check. I don't want to invite anybody who has to go to the bathroom when the bill arrives and they disappear.
Yeah.
I think it'd be fascinating to have dinner with Leonard Bernstein.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Always such a fan of everything he ever did, and certainly with West Side Story.
Yeah.
And
sure.
And his Young People's concerts. he would be great. I was always a huge Zappa fan.
Yeah.
Fun to have dinner with Frank.
Frank Zappa, that would be cool. That would be great.
And another person who I've had dinner with many times, who is just the most delightful person to hang out with, is Dolly Parton.
Oh, wow. Oh,
she's one of the absolute most real people in the world. That could be a real interesting evening.
That could be an interesting evening. And I mean, look at her career, what she's done. I mean, she's really nailed the music industry to bits, to be honest with you, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a trip. We've spent a lot of time together, and she's fascinating and a profound, thoughtful humanitarian. I mean, she really cares about the world. But there's people like Jane Goodall.
Yeah, yeah.
Would be amazing to be with her, or Attenborough.
Yes.
Would be another prayer. I mean, those are the kind of people I really would.
David Attenborough would be.
Yeah. I would want somebody that would raise the game.
Yeah, that would test the brain and think, oh, what am I going to ask you? What can we discuss? Yeah, no, I think that would be an interesting even. Dolly Parton, David Attenborough, Frank Zappa, and you. That would be and Leonard Bernstein. That's quite cool, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. Maybe once we've all passed, maybe there actually is a place where we can all have dinner.
Exactly. I'm sure there is.
I'm probably not going to end up there though. So.
I know we've covered a lot today, Leland. But what do you think next for you? The year ahead. What's the year ahead for you? What is it looking like?
Well, more than anything, I'm really want to focus on the immediate family, which is our band.
Yeah.
Were you familiar with the movie The Wrecking Crew?
Yes. Yes.
Well, Denny Tedesco, who did The Wrecking Crew, has made a documentary film about our group.
Oh, wow.
And there it's in editing mode right now. We should have a rough cut of it probably in the next month or so, because we have no clue what this is like. I mean, we've done a lot of footage. They've done tons of interviews with all the artists we've worked with over the years. So I'm curious. So that'll be coming out at the beginning of next year. So we're going to be working that. We've got an album coming out on the 27th of August that was supposed to be out before the pandemic, but we've been holding off, and now we're finally releasing that. And we were just in the studio a couple of weeks ago and went in and cut 10 new tracks. So we're already way up on an album for the beginning of next year. Now, summer next year, it kind of depends what happens with the band, because Lyle Lovett called me and asked me if I would do his summer tour next year. And that's usually about 2.5 months or 3 months of work. I'm just kind of playing it by ear. There's lots going on. Potentially, I was supposed to do. There's a guy named Martin Tillman, who we were supposed to do like a year and a half ago. We were supposed to do this huge concert. He plays. He's an electric cellist who does most of Hans Zimmer's movies.
Yes,
and we were going to do this big gig in Switzerland. It was really amazing. And then COVID hit, and it all got shut down. Still talking about maybe being able to do that, and the immediate family. We'll probably, if all is well, we'll be going back to Japan, and we're looking at just opening up touring for us. So, you know, there's potentially a lot going on. And then I'm still dealing with my book.
Yeah.
That I'm taking a bunch to the post office today, and I'm looking for UK and European distribution, because it's cost too much to mail it. So I'd like to just be able to ship over a pile of books to a fulfillment center and just let people order over there. And same with Japan. And I'm going to continue on with the YouTube channel and working at home and everything. So I'm kind of just, but again, I'm taking this all a step at a time, because so much is predicated on the health of the world.
Yeah, sure.
And until it's really safe and showing that we can pursue doing all the things that we want to do, if it doesn't feel, you know, safe, we're just not going to do it.
No, I completely agree. And also, as well, we may see you in the UK, and if you're in the UK, Lynn, I think we've got to hook up for a beer. I think that would be really cool.
I would love it. And I think the only other stuff that I'm going to just throw out there is if anybody wants to join, you know, the clubhouse.
Yeah.
And stuff. Every one of my videos on YouTube has links on it, and one of them is to this thing called Flat Five, and that's the clubhouse website that Aaron runs for me and for Rick Beato and all these different people. And it's like $10 a month to join. It's not like, you know, some big deal, but it's the two live streams and things like that. And there's a gift shop in there where we've got T-shirts and pictures and mugs and all the, you know, the merch stuff. But then also on that is the link to my website where the book is. If anybody's interested, the book is 6,000 photographs of everybody imaginable giving me the finger.
Yeah.
So, and people have gone nuts for this. I mean, they can't believe it. And then everybody goes, oh, I got to get more of these for gifts and stuff. And I was going to have my website just be lelandsklar.com, and somebody bought up every incarnation of that. So I said the hell with that. And so on that, it's listed as lelandsklarsbeard.com. And so the book is there. I also have T-shirts there that have my beard on the front of the T-shirts. I keep getting pictures of people wearing my beard on them. And then I was a graphic artist, so there's a whole bunch of like museum quality prints of drawings and paintings that I've done that are on that. So, you know, I went from like just wanting to be on tour to like running sort of a small retail cottage industry.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think I did see a photo on Instagram because one of my friends that we know quite well, David Halfant, good friend of ours, and David's been on our show and known David a long time, and one of his pictures popped up with you and him, and it was really quite good. So I'll have to he's given the finger, and I'll have to sort of check in with him on that one.
please. Yeah, David's one of the co-managers of the Immediate Family.
Yeah. Oh, he's David's wonderful. Yeah. Guy.
Yeah, we've known each other for a long time.
Yeah, he's
fun working with he.
Oh, he's brilliant. I love him to bits, and he's again, very gracious, and he's just a cool guy. So when I check in with him, I say, I just saw a picture with you and Leland. Are you giving the middle finger?
Yeah, the challenge was getting the English for cats like Peter Frampton and stuff, because everybody wanted to give me the English version of the finger.
Yeah,
and I let Peter and Tony Smith get away with doing something else, but like when I got Charlie Watts, he just went for the traditional American finger, and Phil Collins and Jeff Beck and all those people just flipped me off regularly.
It's your signature, I think. I think that's really cool.
It became it, and it was an accident. I was not a person who ran around giving the finger all the time, but it was an accident that happened on a Phil Collins tour in 2004. It sort of started by accident and turned into a whole other thing, and now it's suddenly everybody that sees me gives me the finger.
But in a good way.
I mean, it's loving. It means you're number one, I guess. That's what I try to think.
Exactly. Well, unfortunately, Lynn, we've come to the end of our chat. I mean, I obviously could chat with you all day, all week, and it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you.
It's an absolute pleasure to me, too. And if you ever want to do volume two, I'm always here for you. But right now, the main thing is stay safe. Let's keep our fingers crossed for a better road ahead for everybody.
Well, that's all for today's episode of The Entertainment Engine. And thanks for listening.
Join us again next week for more great guest interviews from the world of entertainment. It would be great to have your feedback on the show, so please drop us a message at any time. We would love to hear from you.
So make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast platforms so you never miss an episode.
Thanks for listening to the show, and remember to all stay safe.
The Entertainment Engine.